Professor Oded Lifshitz from the Department of Archaeology and Ancient Near Eastern Cultures at Tel Aviv University is inviting you to join him to a journey following those who composed the historical descriptions in the Hebrew Bible.
The Untold Story of the Kingdom of Judah, Part E. The Untold Story about the Kingdom of Judah in the days of the biblical historiographers. Chapter 6. The Untold Story of King Menashe. This chapter deals with the most untold story about one of the kings of Judah. King Menashe reigned longer than any of the others king of Judah. The opening formula for his reign in the second book of Kings, chapter 21, verse 1, state that Menashe was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. He was the son of Hezekiah and the grandfather of Josiah, and during his long reign, Judah recovered from the severe blow inflicted upon it during Sennacherib's campaign. Judah was integrated into the Assyrian Empire, which was at the height of its power and strength. And the archaeological evidence from the excavations in Jerusalem, in the Benjamin region, and around Jerusalem, including from the excavation at Ramat Rachel, Mordot Arnona, and Armon HaNatziv, testify to the prosperity of the area during this period. The economy and administration continue to develop, and Menashe is also mentioned in Assyrian documents as a king who maintained his loyalty to Assyria and fulfilled his duties as a vassal. Yet, nothing was written in the Book of Kings about Menashe, except for the very broad description of the cultic sins of his day. This is the most extreme example of an untold story in the Book of Kings, of a king who was completely suppressed from the biblical historiography, and all his deeds were erased. And all of this in a period very soon after his reign, when many details about the king and the kingdom of Judah in his time were known to the authors and their readership, even without the need for any written sources. Indeed, when the Judean history was written, a few years after the death of Menashe, the information about his days lived on and existed in the memory of the authors and their target audience in Jerusalem, who had lived in the days of Menashe and knew about the events of his time closely. Still, the story of Menashe is left untold. Menashe's the biblical historiography became a king about whom only the cultic sins he and his kingdom committed are considered worth telling. In this chapter, after an examination of the historical background of the days of Menashe and the information available about this period from archaeology and historical sources outside the Hebrew Bible, we will return to examine the biblical descriptions of his time to seek out the reasons for the untold story of this king. But let's start from the beginning. The 55 years of Menashe's reign must be determined to be between 695 and 640 BCE. This means that his reign included 10 years in which he was a regent at the same time as the last 10 years of the reign of his father, King Hezekiah, and scholars have already suggested that the long years of regency stem from the severe defeat of Judah during Sennacherib's campaign, the severe opposition that arose to Hezekiah following the destruction, the loss of territories, especially in the lowlands, and the need for a long restoration of the kingdom. Moreover, since Hezekiah was 25 years old when he acceded to the throne and reigned for 29 years, it appears that he died when he was 54 years old. When Menashe acceded to the throne, even if as a regent 10 years before his father's death, He was 12 years old. Thus, he was born when his father was 32. It is likely that at this time Hezekiah had more children, but perhaps the older sons were taken to Assyria as hostages, as was the prevailing custom in Assyria. In fact, the Assyrian annals note that after Hezekiah's surrender, a heavy booty was taken from the city, I'm quoting, together with his daughters, his palace women, his male and female singers. He also dispatched his messenger to deliver the tribute and conduct an enslavement ceremony. End of quote. During Menashe's reign, the Assyrian Empire reached the height of its power. Esarhaddon, son of Sennacherib, came to power after his father's murder in 681 BCE and reigned until 669 BCE. He was very active in the entire region stretching from the border of Egypt, including a series of campaigns directed against the 25th Kushite dynasty. The most important campaign carried out by Esarhaddon took place in 671 BCE, when the Assyrian army conquered all of Lower Egypt, the Delta area, very wisely, and knowing that the Assyrians would not be able to annex and manage Egypt. Esarhaddon left the local princes in the Egyptian Delta in place, consolidated their rule with the appointment of local officials, and left with them Assyrian military units which were intended to help them against the rulers of the Kushite dynasty. The great achievement of the Assyrians in the day of Esarhaddon was the elimination of the threat of this dynasty on the southern Levant and the full establishment of Assyrian control over the entire area, since from this stage onward, the small kingdoms that remained in the region had no chance of getting Egyptian aid for the possible rebellion in Assyria. And without such aid, they had no chance of rebelling. As part of the Assyrian consolidation in the region, Esarhaddon was active also along the Phoenician coast and sought to establish Assyrian rule there as well. At the very beginning of his reign, in 677 BCE, he embarked on a campaign against the city of Sidon, destroyed it, and founded in its place a new Assyrian city that bore the king's name, Kar Esarhaddon, which became the capital of a new kingdom established on most of the territory of the destroyed kingdom of Sidon. In light of this, we can understand why in an Assyrian inscription dated 1 year later, 676 BCE, 10 years after Menashe acceded to the throne, all the kings of the region are mentioned as kings of the land of Hatti and beyond the river, who were recruited by Esarhaddon to carry cedar trees and stones from the mountains of Lebanon, for the purpose of building the king's new palace in Nineveh, his capital. Among these kings, we can find the name Menashe, king of Judah. He is also mentioned in the inscription. Another achievement of Esarhaddon was the orderly transfer of power to his son Ashurbanipal. In 672 BCE, he made an arrangement for the succession to the throne and divided the power in the empire between his two sons, Ashurbanipal in Assyria and Shamash-shum-ukin in Babylon. Therefore, when Esarhaddon died during a military campaign to Egypt in 669 BCE, there were no shocks throughout the empire, and his two sons ascended to the throne according to the arrangement made by their father. Ashurbanipal reigned between 668 and 631 BCE. The first 5 years of his reign were challenging, and Assyria almost lost control of Egypt when, in the first year of his reign, Taharqa, king of Cush, conquered Memphis. The Assyrian army was sent on a military campaign in Egypt, where it was joined by the armies of all the kings beyond the river, beyond the Euphrates, among them the army of Menashe, king of Judah. Taharqa retreated when facing the Assyrian army, and Esarhaddon restored the local rulers to power. After they rebelled against him, apparently with the backing of Taharqa, he enthroned in Lower Egypt Necho I, the ruler of the city of Sais, and appointed his son, Psamtich, to rule the city of Atribis. The situation in Lower Egypt did not stabilize, and only after another invasion by the Kushite dynasty, this time led by Tantuamun, son of Taharqa's brother, did the Assyrian army come out against it and pursue the Kushite army until Noamon, until Thebes, that was conquered and pillaged. All of Egypt fell into the hands of the Assyrians. The Ashurbanipal attained the peak of all Assyrian conquest ever. In order to stabilize the situation in Egypt, Psamtich was made king in Sais and was the most senior ruler among the local rulers in the region. Afterwards, in 656 BCE, Psamtich succeeded in uniting all of Egypt under the rule of the new dynasty he established from his capital in the Nile Delta, the 26th dynasty, the Said dynasty. And Assyria withdrew from Egypt, apparently as part of an agreement with the Egyptian king, who in the following decades continued to be a loyal ally of Assyria. Over the next 20 years, Assyria was at the height of its power and ruled undisputed throughout the ancient Near East. Although Assyria had no naval power and could not threaten the island of Tyre and Arvad, Ashurbanipal annexed mainland Tyre and turned it into an Assyrian province, and his rule over all the vassal kingdoms remained stable. Assyrians' main challenge in these years was the tension between Ashurbanipal and his brother Shamashum-Ukin, king of Babylon, who eventually rebelled against him with the support of the king of Elam. Ashurbanipal conquered Babylon in 648 BCE, continued from there and attacked the kingdom of Elam until 645 BCE. He managed to capture Susa, the capital of the kingdom of Elam, and to destroy it. The periods of the Assyrian peace, Pax Assyriaca, in which Assyria ruled the entire ancient Near East and turned all parts of the empire into one economic and political unit, reached its peak after the conquest of Susa and lasted until the end of the reign of Ashurbanipal in 631 BCE. Judah was just a small part of the mighty Assyrian system, a small vassal kingdom at the southwestern end of the empire. Its economy was integrated into the imperial system, and the Assyrians closely monitored the conduct of the kingdom to ensure its loyalty. The last Assyrian military campaign to the southern Levant, about which there is information in the Assyrian inscriptions, was conducted a year after the conquest of Elam in 644 BCE, and its destination were the cities of Ushu, Tyre, and Acre, Akko, that had rebelled against Assyria. This was a few years before the death of Menashe, so clearly, throughout his reign, Assyria ruled the region in full power. He was a loyal vassal, whether reluctantly or by choice. The prosperity that took place during Menashe's reign all over the kingdom clearly emerges from the archaeological research and has already been discussed and described in previous chapter when we discussed the archaeology around Jerusalem. Despite this, none of Menashe's achievements are described in the biblical historiography. Menashe is described as the great of sinners among all of the kings of Judah, and the description of his reign in 2 Book of Kings, chapter 21, includes only a list of cultic sins. Indeed, we can assume that the description of Menashe as a king in whose day cultic sins prevailed in Judah in general and in Jerusalem and the temple in particular is not completely disconnected from historical reality. During this period, Judah was a part of the Assyrian Empire and took part in inter-kingdom trade. Thus, at least the Jerusalem elite, the merchants, and perhaps also other circles of the population in Jerusalem, were exposed to diverse foreign cultures. Perhaps there was even a tendency in Jerusalem to adapt characteristics of cult, religion, and culture from the Assyrian Empire, whose representatives frequently visited the kingdom's centers and might have stayed temporarily in the administrative centers established near Jerusalem. Despite this, I suggest, following other scholars, that the reason for describing the character of Menashe as a sinner is a historiographical decision by the Deuteronomistic authors, which resulted from the two considerations and prevailed over all other historiographical considerations. The first consideration was the historiographer's political assessment of the kings of Judah, whether they surrendered to foreign empire or rebelled against them. Their theological evaluation of the kings arose from this consideration, and therefore the historiographers create a cross symmetry between the last four kings who reigned until their time, since Assyria took over the area while King Amon, who reigned for less than 2 years before he was murdered, was not considered in this matter, and his actions, character, and evaluation are largely connected to those of Menashe's father and not to those of Josiah, his son. This symmetry includes Ahaz, who was enslaved to Assyria and received a negative theological evaluation. His son, Hezekiah, who rebelled against Assyria, received a positive theological evaluation and is also credited with making a cultic reform. Menashe, the son of Hezekiah, who was a loyal Assyrian vassal and received a negative theological evaluation, and Josiah, Menashe's grandson, in whose days Judah was freed from the Assyrian yoke, received a positive theological evaluation and is credited with freeing Judah from the Assyrian yoke and with making a cultic reform. The second consideration of the historiographers was also connected to the difficult problem they faced. In light of this cross symmetry between the last four kings of Judah who reigned until their day, namely, they had a literary duty to find someone who would spoil what was corrected in Hezekiah's cultic reform so that Josiah would have something to correct again in his cultic reform. The only option, therefore, that they had before them was to attribute to Menashe the cultic sins committed in Judah after Hezekiah so that Josiah could correct these sins in his cultic reform. Indeed, the description of Menashe's sins opens with the statement, I'm quoting from the second book of Kings, chapter 21, verse 3, "For he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed." Later, all the sins attributed to Menashe, without exception, are the exact opposite reverse of what was corrected in Josiah's reform, so that from the literary perspective, Menashe is a mirror image of his grandson, great King Josiah, and Menashe's actions are the negative of the image of the cultic reform that took place in the days of Josiah. And so, the description of the days of Menashe, which can be attributed to the Deuteronomistic historiographers of Josiah's days, includes the usual opening formula in the second book of Kings, chapter 21, verse 1 and verse 2, which of course also contains a negative theological evaluation formula about the king and the usual closing formula in verses 17 and 18, which also includes the description of his burial in the garden of Uzzah, again a topic we dealt with in one of the previous chapters. Following this, the description of Menashe's sin is expanded upon in verses 3 to 8, where every detail described in these verses is linked to Josiah's reform. Moreover, the details selected from Josiah's reform and described in their mirror opposite in Menashe's sins are those related to the purification performed by Josiah in the Brook of Kidron, so a special geographic place below Jerusalem. This is against the description in chapter 21, verse 3, according to which Menashe rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah, as Ahab king of Israel had done, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. The first correction made in Josiah's cultic reform in the second book of Kings, chapter 23, verse 4, corrects these sins exactly. I'm reading. And the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the keepers of the threshold, to bring out of the temple of Yahweh all the vessels made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven. He burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and carried their ashes to Bethel. In contrast to the description of Menashe's sins in chapter 21, verse 4 and 5, I'm quoting, and he built altars in the house of Yahweh, of which Yahweh said, in Jerusalem will I put my name. And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of Yahweh. It is described in Josiah's cultic reform, chapter 23, verse 12, that, I'm quoting, the altars on the roof of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars which Menashe had made in the two courts of the house of Yahweh, he pulled down and broke in pieces and cast the dust of them into the brook of Kidron. Furthermore, in contrast to the description of Menashe's sins in chapter 21, verse 7, and the graven image of Asherah that he had made, he set in the house of which Yahweh said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. It is described in Josiah's reform in chapter 23, verse 6, that, I'm quoting, he brought out the Asherah from the house of Yahweh outside Jerusalem to the brook of Kidron and burned it at the brook of Kidron and beat it to dust and cast the dust of it upon the graves of the common people. End of quote. Through this form of description, the gaps between Hezekiah and Josiah were filled, and it was clear that Josiah's cultic reform corrected the sins of Menashe. However, to expand this, the historiographers added one more verse in chapter 21, verse 6, which was inserted into the description of Menashe's sins, which were corrected in the days of Josiah, so between verses 3 to 5 and 7 to 8, containing a description of the sins that bind Menashe to the book of Deuteronomy and a definition of his sins as a violation of Deuteronomic law. This was accomplished by highlighting the connection between the sins attributed to him and the sins listed in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 9 to 12, where they are defined as the abominable acts of the nations. These sins are framed in the opening verse in chapter 18, verse 9, according to which, when you come into the land which Yahweh your God gives you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations, end of quote. And in the concluding verse, which explained these sins as abominations because of which God dispossessed the Gentiles from their land, in verse 12, I'm quoting, for whoever does these things is an abomination to Yahweh. And because of these abominable practices, Yahweh your God is driving them out before you, end of quote. In the middle, in verses 10 and 11, the sins are defined. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering. Anyone who practices divination, a soothsayer, or an augur, or a sorcerer, or a charmer, or a medium, or a wizard, or a necromancer. In contrast to these sins that are described in the book of Deuteronomy, the sins of Menashe are described in the second book of Kings, chapter 21, verse 6, and I'm quoting, and he burned his son as an offering, and practiced soothsaying, and augur, and dealt with mediums, and with withers, and did much evil in the sight of Yahweh, provoking him to anger. The introduction of the Deuteronomistic law into the picture and the expansion of Menashe's sins according to this law added an additional dimension to the condemnation of Menashe and expanded the definition of his sins beyond the link that the historiographers had created between the cultic reforms of Hezekiah and Josiah. Aside from the description of the sins, the biblical historiographers did not add anything else about the days of Menashe. They single out for him in the story the well-defined role of the one who caused these sins, which Josiah corrected and thus created a one-dimensional character, which matched their assessment of the king, who was both enslaved to Assyria his entire life and also committed serious cultic sins. In this respect, the untold story of Menashe is the most extreme example of the biblical historiographers omitting and ignoring of history itself, and evidence that they acted according to their cultic ideology and in the literary interests of the story they wrote. But Menashe's literary fate did not improve even further down the road. In fact, it got even worse. In the Deuteronomistic history that was expanded after the destruction of Jerusalem, the historiographers of the exilic period used the figure of Menashe, choosing him again for literary considerations as the one whose sins caused Jerusalem to be destroyed and its people to be exiled. Menashe's explicit blame for the destruction and exile was given in a broad addendum inserted into the description of chapter 21 in verses 10 to 16, after which God decided to bring about the destruction due to Menashe's sin. And I'm reading. And Yahweh said by his servants, the prophets, because Menashe, king of Judah, had committed these abominations and has done things more wicked than all that the Amorites did who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. Therefore, thus said Yahweh, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such evil that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. And I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. and I will cast off the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies, and they shall become a prey and a spoil to all their enemies, because they have done what is evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger. Since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day. Moreover, Menashe shed very much innocent blood, till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another, besides the sin which he made Judah to sin, so that they did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. End of quote. In order to close off the circle of additions to the description of the days of Menashe during the exile, and perhaps also to smooth the transition between the original description and the additions, the lengthy description of the scene of the placing the Asherah statue was added in chapter 21, verses 7 to 9, defining God's conditional eternal promise to the temple and Jerusalem, and emphasizes that the violation of God's commandments and the existence of these sins will result in the annulment of the eternal promise, destruction, and exile. Thus, to the description of the original sin and the graven image of Asherah that he had made, he said, the definition of the divine promise was added, I'm quoting, in the house of which Yahweh said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever, and I will not cause the feet of Israel to wander any more out of the land which I gave to their fathers. End of quote. A condition was added to the divine promise. I'm quoting, if only they will be careful to do according to all that I have commanded them, and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them. End of quote. The conclusion from this is that the destruction came on account of Menashe's sins. And if things up to this point were not quite clear, then they become clear in the verse that closes this addition in verse 9. But they didn't listen, and Menashe seduced them to do more evil than the nations had done whom Yahweh destroyed before the people of Israel. End of quote. Beyond doubt, the description of the days of Menashe is an untold story. For historiographical, ideological, and theological considerations, this king was made to disappear and his character was completely maligned. In the next chapter, we will discuss Josiah, a king who is the complete opposite of Menashe, but the story that was left untold about him is even broader and bigger than the one that was told, to the point that almost nothing is known about his days. But in contrast to Menashe, he is presented as the righteous and great king. I can read from 2nd book of Kings, chapter 23, verse 25. Before him, there was no king like him, who turned to Yahweh with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses. Nor did any like him arise after him. End of quote. Yet, the historiographers who worked in the days of Josiah and described him as the greatest of all kings in Judah could not have known that immediately after his days, the deterioration towards destruction and exile would come, and that the end of the kingdom would be closer than one could imagine. All of this will be discussed in the next chapter.